Hi, you're listening to another sermon from Christ Church Anglican Echuca.
Well, I have two sisters and one brother. I'm from a family of four. And they all live back in Queensland, and we don't get to see them that often. You might know that last week was my birthday on Monday. And on Monday, I received a text message from my mum and a voicemail from one of my sisters and her kids all singing happy birthday. And that was it. I didn't hear from the rest of my family. A few days later, I did get a call from my dad, a message saying, sorry, I was pretty busy and I couldn't get to the phone. And when I finally spoke to him almost a week later, he was more upset about the fact that his birthday, which is coming up in a few months, and it's a big one, it's 60, but he was upset that it didn't seem like anybody was planning for his party. And that resulted in many phone calls over this last week about that. Now, I don't tell you this to kind of garner your sympathy, but to illustrate a point I'm sure you well know, even one you might know yourselves. Families break down. We don't always get on with our brothers and sisters or our parents the way that we would like to or the way that we should. It's not that there's any animosity between my siblings and I. We haven't had any big falling out. It's just that we're not a particularly close family. As we continue looking at the patriarchs, we come to the family of Jacob, whom you'll remember God gave the name Israel. And we'll see that his family, his children, they're no better. In fact, they make my family, I'd assume yours, look positively angelic. Now, to properly understand the dysfunctions of Jacob's sons, we need to step back and understand a bit of their family tree and their history. Often that explains what's going on in our families, isn't it? What our previous generations were like. You might remember that Jacob was the younger son of, or the younger twin to Isaac and Rebekah. And after deceiving his father and stealing his brother's birthright, he ran away from home, where he met a beautiful girl and arranged to work 7 years in exchange for her hand in marriage. But because his father-in-law was just as shrewd as he was, Jacob ended up working for him for 20 years, and not just for one wife, and not just for two, but actually for four. Jacob ended up marrying Rachel and her sister Leah, and was also given their handmaidens, Bilhah and Zilpah, as wives. These four wives bear him 12 sons. It's one big, happy family. It's a big family, it's not really that happy. And indeed, if you read chapters 34 and chapter 35 of Isaac, you'll see, even before what we get to today, the seeds of discord are sown among them. But we get to looking at Jacob's children in particular in these coming chapters. We're told this is the story of the family of Jacob. And of those 12 sons, we're told that Jacob loved Joseph more than all the others. It seems that Jacob's forgotten what can happen when parents have favourites. Remember, his twin brother Esau was his father's favourite and he was his mother's favourite. And as we saw 2 weeks ago, we saw how well that turns out. Jacob's forgotten what it's like to not be your father's favourite. And he openly shows his favouritism towards Joseph. We're told it's because Joseph was the son of his old age. He's the baby of the family. He's not quite the baby, he's got a younger brother still, but that's the excuse we're given here, or the reason. The real reason Jacob loved him more is probably due to the fact that Joseph was the first son of the 12 born to Rachel, or by Rachel. And if you remember, she was the one that Jacob really wanted to marry. And probably by the time we get to Genesis 37, Rachel has died, which probably only intensified that connection or the depth of affection that Jacob had for Joseph. Now, on its own, this favoritism would have been enough to kind of set Joseph apart from his brothers and to kind of, you know, sow some discord there and set things off. But we read that as a teenager, Joseph didn't do anything to endear himself to his kin. It all starts when he brings a bad report to their father. Mom and Dad, while they were all out looking after the sheep together, Joseph saw his brothers mucking around, perhaps being careless at their job. Maybe they were relieving the boredom that can come from being a shepherd by playing games with the sheep. But it could be actually that they weren't doing anything wrong at all, or not that bad. The report Joseph brings could be a tall tale or an exaggeration of the truth. In fact, the word that's used there for bad report most often in the Bible has the negative sense of something that's untrue. But whatever it is that Joseph says, Jacob, their father, believes him, which only infuriates his brothers all the more. And it's not clear if it's because of this, because Joseph has come kind of telling his dad what's been going on, or just because Jacob doted on Joseph, we're told that he's given a special coat. Now, those of you who are more familiar with the King James will think of this as a coat of many colours. If you're a fan of musicals, you might think of it as a technicolour dream coat. But as our translation here has it, it's more likely just a robe, a long robe with long sleeves. Perhaps something a bit like this. It's a priestly kind of garment, a royal robe. It might not have been multicoloured, but it was certainly special and it marked Joseph out. This wasn't the kind of thing that you would wear to work tending the sheep. It marked him out as different. Notice, we'll see in the next scene, Joseph seems to be prone to wearing it on any and all occasions. And every time he put it on, it would have been like rubbing salt in the wound. Every time his brothers saw him wearing that coat, they would have been reminded, there he is, our father's favourite. So there's Joseph. He's the favourite. He's the informant. He's the fancy pants, or the fancy coat. And all of these things would have caused, you can imagine, a great deal of friction in the family. Though it's a bit more intense than that. We're told more than once that Joseph's brothers hate him. There's a time when in the heat of the moment you might say to any of your family members, your brother or sister, or even your parents, you might utter out those words, I hate you! But often it's a momentary passing thing. But this is more than an outburst of a moment. Verse 4 ends by saying they couldn't even speak peaceably to Joseph. They couldn't say shalom to their sibling. They couldn't utter even a friendly word of greeting to him. Imagine what that is like. What that says about the gulf that's between them. Jesus said that if you're angry with your brother or sister, you're just as liable as if you committed murder. We'll see in a moment that's what Joseph's brothers were prepared to do. But it's not before Joseph himself throws fuel on the fire. For Joseph had these dreams, you see. And they're not the kind of dubious dreams that might be inspired by a bit of undigested beef or a blot of mustard or a crumb of cheese or a fragment of underdone potato. Nor does it seem these were the product of his own overactive imagination, dreams of grandeur, an extension of his own inflated ego. It's not said explicitly, but the implication is that these dreams come from God. Joseph, though, is a good illustration for us of the fact that even though a person might have a gift from God, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have the wisdom and maturity to use it well. You can almost picture then Joseph kind of swaggering up to his brothers in his fancy coat, perhaps at the time when they're not out shepherding sheep, but are actually harvesting the wheat. You can imagine him walking up to them and saying, you'll never guess the dream I had last night. There's no indication that he thought twice about telling them his dream, of his sheep standing tall, and all of theirs bowing down to his. Dreams play a significant part in the life of Joseph on two other occasions. And on those times, God's help is needed to interpret the dreams. But here the meaning is pretty obvious. His brothers get it without needing to consult anything. They say to him, are you indeed to reign over us? Are you indeed to have dominion over us? They know what this dream signifies. It's another claim from Joseph to be superior to them. And the outcome is not surprising. His brothers hate him even more. They add hate upon hate. They really, really hate him. It's repeated three times through this passage so that we don't miss how they really feel about him. And it's clear, at least at this stage in his life, that Joseph isn't a quick learner. Because he has another dream. Later on, Joseph will say that if God gives a dream twice, it's a sign of its sureness. He has another dream that seems similar to the first, where this time it's the sun and the moon and 11 stars bowing down to him. But this time he doesn't just tell it to his brothers, he tells it to his father as well. And that doesn't go down the way he expects, the way we might expect. His brothers hate him all the more, and his father, even though Joseph is his favourite, he rebukes him for it, repeats what his brothers have said. What kind of dream is this that you have had? Shall we indeed come, I and your mother and your brothers, and bow down to the ground before you? It's an open rebuke. So we read in the next verse that Jacob treasures Joseph's words in his heart. In the same way we later read that Mary treasures the angel's words to her in her heart. There's a sense in which Jacob hangs on to this dream, this prophecy of his son. And perhaps an inclination that he longs for it to come true, at least in some way. But if there's any uncertainty about how Jacob feels about Joseph, we're left in no doubt about his brothers. They're consumed with a jealous rage. And the next scene, which takes place through the rest of the chapter, we see how this long simmering hatred at last boils over. Sometime later, Jacob sends Joseph out to check up on his brothers again. They've gone and taken the family flocks to a place near Shechem, about 70 miles away, 3 or 4 days' journey. Joseph is sent to go and check up on them and see how things are going. And it's a long journey, one that would have taken him far out away from home and far away from his father's protective arm. Yes. Quite a little lost on the way, but has to get pointed along. And all of a sudden the scene shifts. We're standing with Joseph's brothers, who can spot him coming from a mile away in that fancy coat of his. We see just how deep their hatred for him runs. They go very quickly from sarcastically calling him that master dreamer to plotting his downfall. That actually makes it sound innocent. They don't miss their words. They quite openly say, there he comes, this dreamer, let's kill him. Let's murder him. What they're planning is nothing short of cold-blooded murder, and they're open about it with each other. Thankfully, cooler heads prevail, and the oldest son, Reuben, in a spot of kind of responsibility, says, hang on a second, guys, let's not take this too far. He is our brother after all, let's not kill him. Let's just beat him up, take his coat away, and throw him in a pit. That'll teach him a lesson. And that's exactly what they do. Joseph arrives, they strip him of his special coat, and they throw him in the nearby cistern, which, thankfully, we're told happened to be dry at the time. And then, kind of the most callous thing of all, they just sit down and calmly have their lunch, as though nothing had happened. There's no doubt that Joseph wouldn't have taken this kind of line down. You can imagine how hard he would have fought against them and how he might have been screaming at them from the bottom of the well to let him out. Indeed, years later, the brothers say that they can still hear his cries for mercy ringing in their ears. But as it's presented in Genesis 37, he doesn't utter a peep. He doesn't say a word. Much as Jesus would later be silent before his accusers, both of them appear as lamb silence before the slaughter. At that moment, Judah, one of the other brothers, looks up and sees a caravan of merchants travelling nearby, and suddenly he has an epiphany. But see, they've decided not to kill Joseph, but they still haven't worked out what to do with him. If they do let him out of the pit, what's the first thing he's going to do? He's going to run home and dump on them to Dad. They can't really let him do that. Judah has this kind of brilliant insight. He says, here comes some traitors. Let's not kill our brother. That's a bit drastic. Let's just sell him as a slave. It's a win-win solution. They get rid of their brother without having to murder him, and they make a tidy bonus in the meantime. And so they sell Joseph for 20 pieces of silver. So they can't go back home empty-handed. And if they went back without anything, their father would just send them out again to look for Joseph, and they'd be stuck. So they carry out the second part of their original plan. They kill a young goat and dip Joseph's coat in, and they take that home and say to their father, oh look, we found this. What do you think it means? There's a deep irony here. If you remember from his childhood, Jacob had deceived his father, Isaac, using his brother's coat and the flesh of the goat. Now his sons are playing kind of the same trick on him, and he falls for it. Without any prompting from him, he comes to the conclusion that Joseph must have been attacked and eaten by wild animals. And he cries out in mourning 3 times. In fact, he keeps on crying. He's determined to lament for the rest of his life, he says. Nothing will console him. All of his other sons and their wives come in and try and get him to move on. But none of it works. He's determined to carry his grief to the grave. You can imagine how this made the other boys feel. They thought at long last they'd gotten rid of Joseph. And he's gone, but their father hasn't let go. He keeps on carrying on about them every day. Now, there's some pretty obvious issues that this passage raises for us. Some very clear examples and lessons we can learn from it. Parents shouldn't have favourites. You shouldn't show off to your family. You should love your brothers and sisters and not pick them up and throw them in a well. You shouldn't deceive your dad. Now, these are all good and important lessons for us to learn. But there's another question that lurks beneath the surface. What does this mean for God's plans and promises? In fact, this is the question we've seen running through all the accounts of the patriarchs. At every step, in every generation, the action of people puts God's promises in peril. Abraham and Sarah took matters into their own hands, trying to have a son their own way, instead of waiting and trusting in God. Isaac is nearly sacrificed and lost. Jacob is the last kind of person you'd expect to be inheriting God's promises with all his unscrupulous behavior. And while there's now 12 sons of Israel who will later become the 12 tribes of Israel, one of them's now missing in action. And given Joseph's dreams earlier, if that really was a promise or a prophecy from God that he would rule over his brothers, what now? How can God's promises be fulfilled? Chapter 37 ends with a small glimmer of hope in verse 36, which is kind of a footnote. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold Joseph in Egypt of Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. As far as Jacob is aware, his son Joseph is dead. His brothers know the truth, and so do we now. Joseph is taken away and sold as a slave. At least he's alive. And while he's sold as a slave, he actually ends up in a pretty favoured position. He's a slave to one of the officials, one of the highest ranking members in the land of Egypt. Even though his suffering will increase by being falsely accused in the prison, as we'll see next week, this way of suffering will ultimately and eventually lead to his exaltation to the highest post in the land of Egypt. His brothers will come and bow down before him, just as he dreamed. Joseph's dreams will come true. God's plans will be fulfilled. is just the beginning. We've seen the beginning of how God can use even evil and unfortunate circumstances for his own good. God can use even our misfortune or our mistreatments to make his promises come about. God is not absent. He's quietly at work behind the scenes to accomplish his purposes. God can work out his plan of salvation even through the wrongdoing we experience. Even when evil seems to rule the day, we can rest assured that God is in control. Sometimes, though, we just have to wait and see what that looks like. And then we'll have to do and wait for the next week. Let me pray for us. Gracious Lord, sometimes you call us to wait for the unknown. Sometimes we can feel lost. Sometimes we can feel abandoned or mistreated. Help us, Lord, in those times to continue to trust in you. Help us to remember that you always work your purposes out and that your plans are never wrong. Help us, Lord, to follow you in faith, whatever circumstances might come our way. We pray this in the name of your Son, Christ our Lord.